Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Martin Tanner, co-hosting with Terry Hutchison. Our Come Follow Me topic tonight is Insights into Doctrine and Covenant, Sections 106, 107, and 108. Before we get started, I need to tell you that the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the LDS Church. We do that through the latest and best scholarship, which we make available to you in the form of podcasts, journals, articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables, all free at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends and consider giving us a 5-star rating. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Libsyn, and all kinds of other great podcast apps. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, any of the comments that we make tonight or that you find on our website are solely our own responsibility. And with that, onward into the amazing content of sections 106, 107, and 8 of the Doctrine and Covenants. Terry's going to start us off with some historical background and context.
Thank you, Martin. It's great to be on this episode with you of the podcast for our Come Follow Me tonight.
Thanks.
Well, I keep saying tonight.
That's all right.
We need to tell Alan to cut that out, you know? Alan,
we
pay
can
attention.
Do that.
Bracket
we can do
this.
That.
Okay.
Yeah. I can restart it for a sec if you want. I mean, I'm open with that.
Well, whatever you want to do. Okay. We'll get him to cut it out.
Okay.
You know, 106 is about Warren Cowdery. So Warren is the older brother of Oliver Cowdery. And I got to tell you, Martin, I love Oliver Cowdery. Among all the early church leaders,
yeah,
he's the one. I don't know. It's like I want to know a little more about him. We still to this day don't have a biography of him. And
that's true.
I hear a rumor that someone has picked up where Scott Fallring left off, and Scott Fallring had stuff going on, but he wanted to wait for Anderson. I can't remember his first name. Come on, help me out, Martin.
if I knew who you're referring to,
he's the one that wrote
the
investigating the Book of Mormon Witnesses. Come on.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Richard
anyway,
Lloyd Anderson.
Richard
yeah.
Landerson. Richard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but Richard lived to be about 97 or something. And
yep.
So, and Fallring, I guess, had something happen to him and he died in a, he had some serious health problems and passed away without finishing. I've heard a rumor that someone is working on it. I don't know who that is, but I wish them well, and I'm looking forward to it. But Warren has a real interesting story himself. He's Oliver's older brother, and he was always sympathetic to the church. I mean, Oliver was the second elder. He joined, he's one of the first members. But Warren never joined until 1834. And I guess he joined when Joseph was going through Freedom New York and collecting donations and getting participants in the Eastern countries for Zion's camp. And Joseph and Parley P. Pratt passed through Freedom. They stayed overnight at their home where they were treated hospitably. And eventually Pratt recalled 30 or 40 people were baptized. They preached more than once to a house crowded full to overflowing. And apparently, while there's no record of it, Warren and his wife were some of those who were baptized at this time. And we can learn more about Warren Cowdery, obviously, in the Saints volumes, but in the Revelations in Context, which is that great companion to the DNC that came out about 4 years ago, written with individual articles that are written, and each article is named as to who wrote it, by members of the Church Historical Department. And this one on Warren is written by Lisa Olson Tate. And I highly recommend it to people because it is so inspiring to see the lives of some of these members of the church that we really don't know much about. I mean, Warren's clearly overshadowed by Oliver, But he's pretty great. And one of the fascinating things about this that struck me was that Warren's letter referred to the saints in Freedom as their brethren and sisters. There were about 65 people in their branch, and he wrote to Oliver, and he wanted to have some great preacher who could come and preach to them and help them spread the gospel and strengthen the saints. And what do you think the Lord's response to that was? Section 106. Warren, you asked for it, you got it, but it's not a Toyota. It's you asked for it, you got it. You are called to be the president and leader of the branch in Freedom. And the branches in the early saints, there's a lot of interesting information about them because they got to be very large, and then almost immediately they got small because of the gatherings to Kirtland or to Missouri. So at one point, Freedom had about 40 members, but a few miles away, another branch that had been very large had 8 members. And so it was really I'm sure it was a real fascinating administrative task to figure out how to work all of this. And that's what's great about this section of the Doctrine and Covenants. I would also recommend to everybody, BYU Studies, in its last 3 volumes, has started a series of articles about the administrative history of the church. And I would recommend that you pick that up. The latest one, which came last to me last week, has it's 1851 to 1859. But to learn about this period during Warren's life, I'd recommend you get 2 issues ago. And I think it's volume 63. I want to say it's volume 63, beginning with issue 1. But having said that, Martin, let's go to the DNC and find out what this section says. So go ahead.
Perfect. This is a very, very short section, only 8 verses, and it has apocalyptic sort of languages in here, language about the second coming. And in verse 3, it talks about the laborer being worthy of his hire, and verse 4 specifically talks about the second coming and, being sure that it doesn't overtake the world as a thief in the night, and specifically telling Warren Cowdery to gird up your loins, which in modern English means get your act together and get everything ready, and get with the program. And then it talks about why this is requested of Warren, and that's because he is supposed to be one of the children of light, that day shall not overtake him, that the day of Christ's second coming will not overtake him as a thief in the night. All this apocalyptic literature is fascinating, because we say to ourselves, well, gee, this was back in 1834, almost 100 years ago now, and what's this coming quickly and happening soon and everything, and we're almost 100 years later. But what the message really behind it isn't so much it's going to come in a few months or a few days or quickly in a few years. It's that we're supposed to be ready, because when it happens, it's going to happen suddenly, just as the Roman incursion at the time of Christ. And you read about the 24th chapter of the book of Luke, and about the second coming, and that's the kind of information Jesus is saying, when these events happen, when the Romans come, it's going to happen all at once, and you need to be ready. And the similar language is being told to Warren Cowdery here: be ready for it, because when it happens, it's going to happen quickly. And of course, he's passed on, so the information that is given to him is the same that's given to all of us, and that's really You don't know when you're going to die. It could be today, tomorrow, or next Thursday. And so be ready for it. So when you're standing there before the Savior, you're going to feel okay about your life and what you did.
Well, I also like the fact that in verse 5, he tells him, "Gird up your loins," as you were saying, that you may be the children of light, and the day shall not overtake you as a thief. I mean,
Yes.
we have a prophet, President Russell M. Nelson, who has specifically and very literally said, "The second coming of the Lord is near, get ready." And if I recall, he made that point of that in one his conference talk, not this last conference, but the conference before, what, 22 times or seven or eight or some many multiples of times when he said, "The Lord is coming." So obviously, if we just would follow that, we're going to be in good shape. I also love this line here. "Again, verily, I say unto you, there was joy in heaven when my servant Warren bowed to my scepter and separated himself from the crafts of men." And Warren was, I think all the Cowdrys were very capable individuals. I mean, he was a local official where he lived. He was appointed to oversee some of the things for the community. And when he joined the church, he did suffer some criticism of that, and I'm sure he lost some of that in the eyes of his fellow citizens. But he stuck it out and then transferred his administrative abilities to serving the Lord in Freedom, New York, in this way. And he bowed, like he said, he bowed to his scepter and separated himself from the crafts of men. I really enjoyed this section, even though it's very short.
Very short. Would be
Now,
an amazing thing in the early days of the church to have some few little verses like that written about you for
well,
all posterity.
really, yeah, I mean, we have other sources, but the only thing that the majority of members of the church know is his name in this context. And
Yes.
really, Martin, that applies to our guy in section 108. Maybe we should just go to that one, and then we can spend the rest of the time on the really long one that's in the middle, which is section 107. So I think we could take it slightly out of order, because
Sure, I'm fine with that.
108 has some fascinating things too. So once again, we have this situation with the Revelations in context. There's a whole chapter on Lyman Sherman, and I didn't know much about him. But this is a really fascinating story. Joseph Smith's journal on Christmas Day of 1835 said, "At home all this day, enjoyed myself with my family, it being Christmas Day, the only time I have had this privilege so satisfactorily for a long time." So here's the prophet, just his family. All of the burdens of this church and the challenges are out there. The next day was a Saturday. Joseph sat down with a few companions, commenced studying the Hebrew language when a knock came at his door. Standing there was his friend Lyman Sherman. Sherman said, "I have been wrought upon to make known to you my feelings and desires, and was promised that I should have a revelation which should make known my duty." DNC 108 is that revelation. So before we talk about the revelation, we can learn a little more about Lyman Sherman. He was 31 years old, and fourth anniversary of his baptism was approaching. So he joined the church in 1831 when he was 27. Early in the fall of 1831, two brothers of his wife had left home to work, and they wrote back to the family they had been baptized into the Mormonite church. "This news came upon us almost as a horror and a disgrace," one of Delsina's brothers stated. "But shortly after the letter arrived, they sent a package containing the Book of Mormon and a lengthy explanation of their beliefs." I'd love to see that letter. That would be fascinating. But after they got the letter, the materials, Benjamin wrote, "My my mother, Brother Seth, Sister Nancy, and Lyman R. Sherman, with some of the neighbors, all devoted to religion, would meet together secretly to read the Book of Mormon and accompanying letter, and perhaps to deplore the delusion into which my brothers had fallen. Well, they were initially skeptical, but as they read, their reading soon led to marveling at the simplicity and purity of what they read and at the spirit which accompanied it, bearing witness to its truth. And several of them, Lyman and his wife among them, and members of her family were baptized in January of 1832. And then members of the Sherman family were converted, and then they moved to Kirtland by mid-1833, where they came to know Joseph Smith. Now, apparently, one of their sons was about the same age as Joseph III, and so the boys were friends. And Sherman kind of, though, had doubts about the quality of his discipleship, and that ultimately led to him being wrought upon. He obviously was praying, Martin, about, am I faithful enough? Am I doing good? What more could I be doing? And this led to him getting this revelation. So eventually, he had participated in a meeting of those who journeyed to Zion with Zion's camp. And at that meeting, Joseph Smith announced it was the will of God those who had gone to Zion should be ordained to the ministry and go forth to prune the vineyard for the last time. And the first 12 apostles were called, as we'll talk about in a minute when we cover D&C 107. But Lyman Sherman was ordained as one of the seven presidents of 70. And before they went all out into the earth, they were to be central participants in the events surrounding the dedication of the temple in the spring of 1836. And by the way, the brother that we just talked about, Warren Cowdery, he was the scribe for D&C 109 and 110. So he's the one who made those entries in Joseph Smith's journal about the dedicatory prayer of the Kirtland Temple, as well as the vision where Jesus and several prophets came and gave keys to Joseph Smith. So anyway, he went on a mission. He served the saints in Kirtland, was eventually called to the High Council. Apparently, he sung in the gift of tongues and proclaimed great and marvelous things while clothed upon at one sacrament meeting in the temple. Wilford Woodruff reported this. He ordained a dozen men to the third quorum of the 70s. And as dissension and opposition joined forces against the church, he and his family remained loyal to Joseph Smith. He was appointed to the Kirtland High Council in October of 1837, moved to Far West Missouri in 1838, and then he was appointed in the fall of that year to the Far West High Council. And by this time, Joseph and the other church leaders were in the Liberty Jail. So in January of 1839, Lyman went to visit Joseph, but as we know, the weather was brutal. He caught a cold, which he never recovered from. So on January 16th, the First Presidency wrote to Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball and designated Lyman Sherman to fill one of the vacancies in the Quorum of the Twelve. Kimball wrote he and Young visited Joseph on February 8th, and when they departed, Lyman Sherman was somewhat unwell, and in a few days after our return, he died. We did not notify him of his appointment. So for me, that was a just reading about his story was fascinating. It really filled in a lot of gaps and added a real great context to this revelation that he has. And this is one of those instances. This isn't like Warren Cowdery. Well, Warren Cowdery prayed for help in his branch, not realizing he was the help that the Lord was going to call and rely on and send to the people. Lyman just prayed and was told, go talk to Joseph and you're going to get a revelation. And here it is. So, Martin, let's talk a little about that, what that revelation entailed. Oh, one other thing. Let me just say this. What's his name? Robert Woodford's, Historical Development of the Doctrine and Covenants, that three-volume work from 1975, his PhD thesis, which is really good. It's too bad it's hard to find. But one of the things that there was a letter written to John Taylor. He said, "Dear brother, I trust you will pardon me for this," President Taylor, "Dear brother, I trust you will pardon me for this trespassing in your time, for you are the only one to whom I can apply. I feel anxious that a work may be done for Lyman P. Sherman, my wife's father, who died in Far West in 1838. I would like to have him and his wife receive the first and second anointings, to have them sealed together and have their children sealed to them. My wife's brother, Albie, the eldest of the family living, has no desire apparently to do anything for his parents, though I have urged him to do so. He has for years been on the background and seems to think nothing of these things. I do not wish to curtail any of his rights, but do wish that a work may be done for my wife's parents while the present opportunity exists. My son Lyman of Logan could act for his grandfather, and I could, if approved, receive the second anointing, the second A for him, my daughter acting for her G mother. I will be satisfied, whatever your decision." I just thought that that letter added some color to the end of this story. So even though he died faithfully, he'd never received his endowments. And so someone was asking President Taylor to do that, even though obviously, you know, they could because of the St. George Temple. But anyway, just part of the story for 108.
Yeah, an amazing part of the story. To the revelation which was given to him, he is told that his sins are forgiven. And there's some fascinating language in verse 2. This is, you know, don't resist the spirit. That's the gist of it. "Therefore, let your soul be at rest concerning your spirituality, and resist no more my voice." That's the exact language. That's kind of interesting that he was resisting the voice of the Lord. Verse 3 says, in effect, take things a little bit more seriously, take your vows seriously, and live up to them with more precision, and be patient until the solemn assembly is called. And the gist of it is that he's told that if he does these things, that he'll be a strength to the brethren, and that quote, "In all your prayers, in all your exhortations, and in all your doings, strengthen your brethren." And God says in the very last verse, verse 8, that he will be with him. So it's a beautiful section. It's a beautiful, short, but very, very beautiful section. I appreciate the additional information you gave there, Terry. That's more information than I've ever known about Warren Sherman.
Well, what's great to me is after this revelation, you know, what I remember one of the things, one of the first interpreter articles I read was by John Gee, one of our co-hosts, and it was on the apocryphal sayings of Jesus. You can look it up. It's in, you know, one of the first year or two of the journal. I think it was 2012, 2013. And one of the things he said was that, and if he didn't say it there, he said it in the Encyclopedia of Mormonism entry, but he said, one of the things we don't know what was taught in the 40-day ministry, but what we do know is that after that, the apostles' commitment to the gospel was fully complete. I'm paraphrasing. John says it better than I could.
No, that's right. Peter didn't doubt anymore, doubting Thomas.
No.
Nobody denied anybody. They went out and
they went out. They, yeah. Yeah.
They were 100% there, even unto death, which all of them but John suffered eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think Lyman's a lot like that, because he really did take this to heart, Martin. After this, he was part of the solemn assembly, as was promised. He had many spiritual manifestations. The Spirit spoke to him. He spoke in tongues, which was a manifestation of the Spirit for many of the early saints. And then he was put on the high council. And then when he moved to Missouri, probably called, he was called to the high council again. Now, how would you like this? You go from Kirtland, where things have really deteriorated, to Missouri, where Okay, it's worse. And then you're put on the High Council again, and you have to stand judgment as part of the High Council for all of these, for a lot of what's going on. And yet you remain faithful and strengthen your brother, and up till the end, you're called to be an apostle, even though you never know it. And you die before the call can take effect, or
Wow.
even
Yeah.
the call can be extended. I'm just really impressed with this, how he followed, and it's such a good example for us. And that's why I think it's important for us to learn, when somebody's mentioned in the Doctrine and Covenants, we should do a little bit of more study to find out, okay, what was the rest of the story? I mean, I remember earlier in our Come Follow Me segments, we've studied people who left the church, but yet were still friendly to the church. And then some of them who left and eventually became atheists. I mean, just lots of different things. And when we see our neighbors and family members and friends, they're all going through the same thing. I'm
They are.
sure you know, and every one of our listeners know, someone, either family, friend, neighbor, has stepped away from the church. And some of them have stepped away to join. I mean, I was shocked, because in one of the wards I moved into in St. George, when I got there, the gospel doctrine teacher who gave great lessons, within a year was going to the Born Again Baptist Church just down the road. He and his entire family, except for the kids that were still on missions. Wild. The Lord's going to sort a lot of that out. But
Yeah.
yet we see this in the early saints, and I think it's important for us to realize they are just like us in many ways.
They are.
So,
Okay, before we run out of you know
time.
what? We will run out of time for 107, but we'll do
Well,
the
for
best we
sure.
can and hit the highlights, so
Well,
we're good.
just a real brief thing about the 107, okay? This
Sure.
is about the administration of the priesthood. But when the Book of Commandments was published, okay, and I want to say the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants. So let me just get back to it here. So after Zion's camp came back in May of, I want to say in May of 1835, okay, in the spring of summer of 1835, four sections on priesthood were collected at the beginning of the new Doctrine and Covenants. Okay, so we had the preface, which was section one. And the first one was now D&C 20, called the Articles and Covenants. Next came the new material from the Instruction to the 12, which was combined with an updated version of the November 1831 Revelation on Priesthood, which is now D&C 107. So that's what we're going to do. So first of all, we had D&C 20, then we had 107, then we had 84, even though 84 was received earlier. I think it's because 107 is more practical in its application. 104 is a bit more theoretical, so to speak. It talks about the oath and covenant of the priesthood. And then came the minutes of the first High Council organization. On August 17th, church members formally approved the Doctrine and Covenants, accepting this revealed organization of the priesthood. But this is fascinating, and it really dovetails well with D&C 84. And you know, sometimes we say, well, gosh, we have favorite scriptures. And 84 and 107 are a couple of mine because of the power of the priesthood. My oldest grandson is currently serving in Brazil. He had his mission farewell in early July of this year. We traveled to Missouri, and he was assigned to speak on the Melchizedek priesthood. He asked me for some advice, and we went over these two sections in particular.
Oh, nice. Wonderful. Wonderful. And Terry, as you mentioned, although no one could say Section 107 isn't spiritual in nature, it is a manual. It is, shall we say, the chart, the organizational chart, if you will, along with the duties for the priesthood, for the Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthoods. And it's fascinating to read it that way, but then to also read into it some of the blessings that are involved. So I'll jump in first here, and mentioned that occasionally people wonder if reference to the Aaronic and Levitical priesthood, as it mentions in verse 1 here, are references to exactly the same thing, or somehow is there a difference between the Aaronic and Levitical priesthoods? And the clear implication in verse 1 here is they're the same thing, the Aaronic including the Levitical priesthood. And so you've got the Melchizedek and then the Aaronic priesthood. Bruce R. McConkie in Mormon Doctrine on pages 9 and 10 says, he just flat out comes out and says, the Levitical priesthood and the Aaronic priesthood, synonymous, same thing, same thing, same thing. And the church has always seemed to treat it that way. Verse 3 gives us some historical background that says that all of the priesthood was originally called the Melchizedek priesthood, but the Aaronic part of it is the outward ways that the actions in it, that the rituals in it are actually performed. And verse 3 says, before his day was called the holy priesthood after the order of the Son of God. Then it
You
goes
know,
on.
I'd just take a little exception to that because I would say my understanding has always been that the Aaronic priesthood covers all three of the offices, of course, but the Levitical priesthood is kind of a subset for teachers and deacons because a priest has the authority to baptize, teachers and deacons do not. And so I'm wondering if there's maybe that part of it that might be different for that reason. But I, you know.
So you're thinking the Levitical priesthood is not identical to the Aaronic priesthood?
Well, I think it's a subset. I think, you know, there's synonyms for these all the time, but realistically, the office of a priest in the Aaronic priesthood has much more authority to do the ordinances than the other two. The other two are more limited in their approach. But I could be wrong. I mean, you know,
Okay,
I'm
well,
just throwing that out there. I don't know. I'm sure we'll get comments.
I'm sure we'll get comments. Verse 5, all other authorities or offices in the church are appendages to this priesthood, meaning the Melchizedek priesthood that's mentioned in verse 4. So everything in the church happens based on the authority of the Melchizedek priesthood. And then in verse 6, it says there are two divisions or grand heads. One's the Melchizedek priesthood, and the other is the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood. And then verse 7 says the office of an elder comes under the priesthood of Melchizedek. And so that's what your grandson was doing. He was talking about the Melchizedek priesthood. So,
Yeah.
let's see, one more comment here, and then I'll toss the baton to you. And that is that there's some fascinating wording here in verse 8 about the powers, because when Joseph Smith died, who had the power? That was a big question. Who was going to succeed Joseph Smith, or was anybody going to succeed Joseph Smith? And you have this verse 8 in section 107 that says the Melchizedek priesthood holds the rights of presidency. That's the prophet and the first presidency, the whole first presidency, the prophet and the two counselors, or however many counselors they have. And the presidency has power and authority over all offices in the church. So it's the presidency. And then when the presidency is dissolved, that's basically subsumed back into the quorum of the 12, which also has equal authority to the first presidency, as we will read a little bit later on in section 107 here. So this is very well thought out very early on, way before Joseph Smith passed away and there was any kind of a succession issue.
Well, yeah, but and also I would just point out that the succession issue, fell on the 12 as a whole. And for the first three or four transitions between presidencies in our church history, the 12 unitedly led for a period of time. Now they reorganize almost immediately a new first presidency. But the reasons behind that, I think, were really well brought out by Ron Esplin in his article that was published in Sustaining Joseph Smith, A Life Lived in Crescendo. That's an interpreter book. It's not just a look, I'm not going to. I'm a fan of that. I wrote a review of it in Meridian, but I'm not mentioning it because it's an interpreter book. I'm mentioning it because, to me, Ron Esplin's work on this is definitive. In spite of what others might say on their little YouTube videos or Facebook videos that they post, I heard one the other day that really kind of got me irritated from somebody, but I'm not going to say who it was. But Ron Esplin's work to me is definitive, and it's about 100 pages. And I would encourage anybody, it's an expansion of a work that he did many, many years ago. And it's
Ron
just great.
Esplin is a great scholar, and he's a delightful gentleman. And I oppose anybody who thinks his work is not quite up to snuff or whatever they had to say. Ron Esplin would do a superb job on anything that he undertook to write.
But going on forward, I
Sure.
also would indicate that the high priests after the order of the Melchizedek priesthood have a right to officiate in their own standing. Okay, they talk about those things, and then a little later, they distinguish between the Aaronic and the Melchizedek and the bishop, and how the bishop is the president of the Aaronic priesthood. Okay. But I like this one. Verse 18 and 19 really, for me, go hand in hand with DNC 84 and 18 through 22. So we talk about the oath and covenant of the priesthood in section 84. And for me, that's all well and good because it's really important for us to know that we have a covenant when we magnify our callings. But that's where it talks about the priesthood. Has the ordinances of the Melchizedek priesthood help us to know the mysteries of God? And without that, we cannot enter the presence of God the Father and live. So in verse 18 and 19, the power and authority of the higher or Melchizedek priesthood is to hold the keys of all the spiritual blessings of the church, to have the privilege of receiving the mysteries of the kingdom, to have the heavens opened unto them, to commune with the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn, and to enjoy the communion and presence of God the Father and Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. The keys of all the spiritual blessings of the church are held by the presidency of the Melchizedek priesthood, which is, of course, the first presidency. And, in a kind of a joint status, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. But what are those blessings, Barton? I mean, we think about this. What are all the spiritual blessings of the church? And I think it's more than just the endowment. I think it's the ordinances of the Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood, the saving ordinances for sure. But I also think it's the gifts of the Spirit as we use them to minister to people, and the power of the priesthood itself that is unlocked in us as we serve our fellow men and women. Just a thought.
Great comments. Great comments. Every time I read verse 15, which says the bishopric is the presidency of this priesthood and holds the keys or authority of the same. And then verse 16, no man has a legal right to this office to hold the keys of this priesthood, except he be a literal descendant of Aaron, but a high priest of the Melchizedek priesthood has authority to officiate anyway. Basically, if there's no literal descendant of Aaron, then you get called in the normal way. I have yet to hear of a ward or a stake where somebody wandered up and said, "Oh, by the way, I'm a literal descendant of Aaron." I don't know what that would do, but this language here has always been so fascinating to me because there is really something there, or this language would not come up over and over again. But as far as how it would play out in practice. To the best of my knowledge, we don't have any example of somebody wandering up and saying, "Hey, I'm a literal descendant of Aaron, and I'm the bishop."
Yeah, that's right.
That's fascinating to
Well,
me.
Martin, I think our time's up, but thank you for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Any parting comments here that you want to make
Well,
about?
I thought we were over time, but I'm
Well,
happy to comment.
you can make a parting comment or two. We can always chop it down just a little bit. I'm grand with that. If there's anything
Oh
else you
no,
want to say.
I'm okay. Well,
Okay. Well.
the rest of this is just fascinating in terms of it operating kind of as a handbook of instructions.
That's right. It's a handbook of instructions. It's fascinating. This will be my last comment about it. And that is that it's amazing how precisely the First Presidency and Quorum of the 12 adhere to what's required in Section 107. They never move forward on an issue unless, as verse 27 says, they have unanimous consent.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing because there are apparently issues that come up from time to time, and there's no unanimity. And so it gets tabled sometimes for weeks, months, or years.
Well,
And
one example, Martin, really quick. When they talked about combining the elders and high priest quorum, I'm aware that this was discussed when President Benson was the president of the 12. And during that discussion, Elder McConkie had one side, Elder Packer had another, and I've seen the excerpts from the minutes, a very respectful, detailed conversation, and they were quoting this exact same conversation that was held during the presidency of John Taylor. That's how far back it went. And
wow.
even then, even though that was in the 1970s and eight or 80s, it wasn't approved by them all until they were all unanimous, and that was right before COVID in 2019 or 18. So fascinating.
That's
You're
a great
absolutely
comment.
right about that, Martin.
I did not know it had been around for that long. That is quite amazing. Parting thoughts for me. Take a look at the information here about the equal in power of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12, and also about Adam on Diamond, starting in verse 53 and the Book of Enoch. It says, these things are written of in the Book of Enoch and are to be testified of in due time. Well, we have some, let's shall we say, slightly apostate versions of the Book of Enoch, but there's some fascinating things in there if you ever want to take a look and find it.
It tracks very well with DNC 76.
Yes. Okay. And with that, we are about out of time, so join us again next time with the Interpreter Foundation when we provide you with Come Follow Me segments and also discussion segments. And please consider giving us a 5-star rating and going to our webpage, which has wonderful information. Martin Tanner and Terry Hutchison signing off.